seekers. My name is Mike Malloy, and I'm here tonight to thoroughly piss you off, like I do every night, probably. Hey, listen, is anybody out there paying attention to the Republicans? They're, as Rachel Maddow just pointed out, the Republicans are being very clear. They're telling you categorically what they're going to do when they take power again on Tuesday. And it's got to happen, right? I mean, all the pundits are saying that come Wednesday morning or late Tuesday night, the Republicans, the teabaggers, the neo-fascists will be back in control. It's a done deal. I mean, that's what we're being told by those who are in the know, the pollsters, the pundits, everybody who really understands this stuff. And just, there's no question what they're going to do. They are coming back to absolutely strip away from you every single thing you have left. You think it's rough now? You think the Bush crime family stripped the bark off of your life? You think the Bush crime family took everything they could from you? No. You still have a few things left. But you won't after the Republicans take power Tuesday night. So, you know, what you might want to do is just all you people are going to vote Republican because, by God, you've had enough of, you know, Obama.
Okay.
Just be prepared to open up everything that you have left so that these Republican bastards can reach in and take it all. Okay? Uncle Mike is telling you. I got an email here from Gordon in Oklahoma City. He's got a good website, blog site. It is Gordon OKC, Oklahoma City. GordonOKC.wordpress.com. This is what he writes. Mike, 1 year ago today, President Obama signed the Hate Crimes Act, which amended the 45-year-old law to include crimes against people on the basis of sexual orientation. The usual suspects from the religious right went bat guano crazy and have been spewing the same nonsense about how they're all going to be arrested for preaching that homosexuality is a sin. Ah! Well, it's been 365 days since that bill was signed into law. How many pastors have been arrested? Right. None. At least not for this. Some of them arrested for fraud and graft and crime and child molestation and child rape. And, you know, but for preaching that homosexuality is a sin, how many have been arrested? None. I intend, Gordon writes, to frequently remind as many people of this uncomfortable fact as possible. Lying bastards, those preachers. Among those continuing to perpetuate myths about the Hate Crimes Act and about how preachers are being persecuted, or will be, is a group called the Black Robe Regiment. Glenn Beck mentioned the Black Robe Regiment during his rally, soon-to-be-forgotten rally, a few weeks ago. If you have time, I wrote an article on my blog about the Matthew Shepard James Byrd Jr. Hate Crimes Act and the lying preachers, which focuses on the Black Regiment promoted by Chuck Baldwin, a far right-wing preacher who ran for president as a Constitution Party candidate. Also, I've got a link there which names the Black Robe Regiment preachers by state. There's an interesting name in the group. Does the name Reverend Steve Anderson ring a bell? Or should I say set off an alarm? I don't know who Reverend Steve... I'm going to go to Gordon's website and see what the hell this is. Anyway, blah, blah, blah. Give him hell, Gordon OKC. Go to his website, gordonokc.wordpress.com. Thanks for the reminder. A year ago, the Hate Crimes Act. Oh, I remember. I remember the shrieking and the vomiting on right-wing radio about how the queers now are going to march into all the churches and just, I don't know, just physically assault all these poor Christian preachers and beat them up and do bad things to them, all sorts of bad things to them, if they didn't stop preaching homosexuality was a sin. Has that happened? No. Reverend Eddie Long down here in Atlanta, who has one of those mega churches, 25, 30,000 members. Oh, well, Eddie has a Rolls and a Bentley, and, you know, he's doing God's work, amen? Eddie Long was a strong preacher forever against homosexuality and against gay marriage and so on and so forth. Let a march right through downtown Atlanta, big-ass march. Man, all these people talking about, you know, marriage between man and woman. Yeah, and old Eddie's married, and he's got a couple grown kids. And there's a lawsuit pending against him. Four young men have come forward and said that Reverend Eddie was sexually doing them. So, why are you laughing, Malloy? Are you being anti-homosexual? No, I'm laughing because of the hypocrisy. I always laugh at hypocrisy. What the hell are you going to do? These people are stealing their own fates. We quoted from Dante's Il Inferno the other night, and as you know, the hottest ring in hell is reserved for the hypocrites, right? According to Dante, I mean, who am I to argue, right? He was a strong Catholic, Dante was. So it's been a year since the Hate Crimes Act was signed, and as Gordon points out, there has not been a just an abundance of preachers being handcuffed in their pulpits and taken away by the sex police because these preachers continue to preach that homosexuality is a sin. They can say anything they want to. I mean, after all, they're members of the clergy, right? They are blessed by God or Jesus or whoever to say this garbage. So they and the Constitution protects them, just like. Listen up, you stupid asses. Just like the Constitution happens to protect folks who are gay. Ta-da-da-da-da-da! I do not like them. I do not like you, Dr. Fell. The reasons why I cannot tell. But this I know, and I know full well. I do not like thee, Dr. Fell. Where's that from? Dr. Seuss? No. No.
Well, it sounds suspiciously like, I will not eat green eggs and ham. I do not like them in a bus. I do not like them with a Gus. I do not like them in a tree. I do not like them, don't you see? I do not like them here or there. I do not like them anywhere.
But this is something else. There's another little, not a couplet, but another little rhyming. Last night upon the stair I saw a man who wasn't there at all. He wasn't there again today. I wish to God he'd go away. What's that from? Maybe from
Diary of Dick Cheney?
I don't know. That could be. That could be. That could be. Just like it took me forever to remember where. Here is a candle to light you to bed. Here is a chopper to chop off your head. And it's the rhyming thing about the church bells in London. And it was Orwell had that in 1984. And I had heard that for the longest time. Couldn't figure out where it's from. Here is a candle to light you to bed. Here comes the chopper to chop off your head. All right. We have to take a break here. When we come back, some George Carlin. No, I can't just play one of his bits because he used the F word abundantly. And although I think I should be able to use the F word abundantly too, I mean, why not? Our affiliates, and I mean, Sirius and XM, they don't care. Our affiliates care though, so I shall restrain myself and just read it. You're going to like it. It's Bob Alexander sent it in. All right, stick around. Just remember, the Republicans are being very explicit about what they're going to do to you, your spouse, your children, your grandmammy, your grandpappy, your job future, your ability to breathe air 5 years. They're telling you. So when you vote for them Tuesday and they have this wonderful surge back into power, just remember, they told you. You know you've got to
the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Well, after wondering for the past 50 years where it came from, Susan in Squim, Washington, just enlightened me. It's from a poem. Inspired by reports of a ghost roaming the stairs of a haunted house in Antigonish, Nova Scotia, Canada. The poem was originally part of a play called The Psycho Ed, which the poet had written. And the poet, by the way, is Hughes Mearns. Here's the poem in its entirety, I'll be damned. Yesterday upon the stair I met a man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. I wish he'd go away. When I came home last night at 3, the man was waiting there for me. And when I looked around the hall, I couldn't see him there at all. Go away, go away. Don't you come back anymore. Go away, and please don't slam the door. Slam. Last night I saw upon the stair a little man who wasn't there. He wasn't there again today. Oh, how I wish he'd go away. Well, thanks, Susan. I swear, I've been listening to that for half a century. It used to scare the hell out of me when I was a kid. I'll be darned. Thank you, Susan. I have a guest coming up for you at 10 o'clock. And I don't do guests. But this woman's going to blow your socks off. I had her on a couple years ago. And I'm going to reintroduce you to her. Bob Alexander said, I took time out from what I was doing today to watch Obama on The Daily Show. It was what it was. If I cared, I'd be massively underwhelmed, although I did painfully flinch hearing our president corporate spokesperson use the word progressive. But that was just a meaningless reflexive response. After watching the 25-minute-long Democratic campaign commercial, I wanted to get rid of the aftertaste of distaste. And I remembered this clip from George Carlin's 2005 HBO comedy special, Life is Worth Losing. Early in the show, George Carlin came up with this great line, I couldn't commit suicide and my life depended on it, and later managed to sum up a political reality perfectly in only 3 minutes and 9 seconds. Quote, there's a reason education sucks, and it's the same reason it will never, ever, ever be fixed. It's never going to get any better. Don't look for it. Be happy with what you've got, because the owners of this country don't want that. I'm talking about the real owners now, the big, wealthy business interests that control all things and make all the important decisions. Forget the politicians. They're irrelevant. Politicians are put there to give you that idea that you have freedom of choice. You don't. You have no choice. You have owners. They own you. They own everything. They own all the important land. They own and control the corporations. And they've long since bought and paid for the Senate, the Congress, the state houses, and the city halls. They've got the judges in their back pockets. And they own all the big media companies. So they control just about all the news and information you get to hear. They've got you by the balls. They spend billions of dollars every year lobbying to get what they want. Well, we know what they want. They want more for themselves and less for everybody else. But I'll tell you what they don't want. They don't want a population of citizens capable of critical thinking. They don't want well-informed, well-educated people capable of critical thinking. They're not interested in that. That doesn't help them. That's against their interest. You know something? They don't want people that are smart enough to sit around their kitchen table and figure out how badly they're getting effed by a system that threw them overboard 30 effing years ago. They don't want that. You know what they want? They want obedient workers. Obedient workers. People who are just smart enough to run the machines and do the paperwork and just dumb enough to passively accept all these increasingly crappier jobs with the lower pay, the longer hours, the reduced benefits, the end of overtime, and the vanishing pension that disappears the minute you go to collect it. And now they're coming for your Social Security money. They want your effing retirement money. They want it back so they can give it to their criminal friends on Wall Street. And you know something? They'll get it. They'll get it all from you sooner or later because they own this effing place. It's a big club and you ain't in it. You and I are not in the big club. By the way, it's the same big club they used to beat you over the head with all day long when they tell you what to believe. All day long, beating you over the head with their media telling you what to believe, what to think, and what to buy. The table is tilted, folks. The game is rigged, and nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. Good, honest, hardworking people, white collar, blue collar, doesn't matter what color shirt you have on. Good, honest, hardworking people continue. These are people of modest means. Continue to elect these rich blankers who don't give a blank about them. They don't give a blank about you. They don't give a blank about you. They don't care about you at all. Not at all. Not at all. And nobody seems to notice. Nobody seems to care. That's what the owners count on, the fact that Americans are and will probably remain willfully ignorant of the big red, white, and blue thing that's being jammed up their things every day. Because the owners of this country know the truth. It's called the American dream because you have to be asleep to believe it.
He watches C-SPAN so you don't have to. It's more Mike Malone.
Before the hour. Also, tonight in the third hour, what are we doing in the third hour? We're doing, as important as the WikiLeaks release regarding Iraq and Afghanistan has been, or have been, I've got something for you, written by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay. There's a link at my website in the little synopsis that Kathy writes every day about what the program's going to be about that night. And it's about Paul Wolfowitz, in part. Primarily, it's just about the Bush crime family. But as important as the WikiLeaks releases were, what Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, investigative reporters for truthout.org, have written is equal to, in terms of pulling the curtain back on the lies and deceptions, equal to the WikiLeaks revelations, or superior to. And I say that not that there's any contest going on here. Each Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay's article and the WikiLeaks releases, each was important in its own right. But Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, using documents that are available and using inside people inside the Defense Intelligence Establishment and other operations, managed to put this this investigative piece together the old-fashioned way. They went out and dug this information out, and what they've come up with is a necessary step in taking responsibility for what we Americans have allowed to happen before we can ever move past the atrocities that we have committed and are in the process of committing against innocent people and try to get some sort of a moral slash spiritual aspect back to our lives. You know, a lot of people listen to this program make the assumption because I'm a full-blown, until the moment I die, atheist. I have no use for religion whatsoever, or their mythologies are interesting to me in the same manner. I mean, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, Hinduism, it intrigues me in the same way that the creation myths and religious myths of the Greeks, the Sumerians, the Romans, pick somebody, you know, some tribe in Africa or Brazil that have their own stories, Native American stories. You know, it's all very interesting. It really is. But I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about spirituality. And I realize that some of those religions did have a heavy-duty spiritual context. Christianity may have started out that way, but it damn sure doesn't anymore. And I don't think Judaism or Islam does either. But I digress. If we are ever to reclaim or to establish some sort of a spiritual moral aspect to the people in this country, it's going to require really working backwards first and exposing some of the horrors that we have perpetrated against the rest of the world over the past 50 years. And friends, I'm telling you, we have done some filth. We have, you know, sure, people like to come to this country. I'm not talking about the country or the opportunity that people from around the world seem to feel is here. I'm talking about the activities of our corporatist government. And we've had a corporatist government for a long time. But I further digress. The article that Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay have written together for truthout.org is another necessary step if we ever are to claim what most Americans say is their birthright. You know, freedom, justice, the American way is so different from other ways. Yada, yada, hog snot. If we ever really want to get to that, well, good. It's a good thing to aspire to, I guess. But it has nothing to do with capitalism, corporatism, or these vile, twisted religious doctrines. Regarding the head stomping that occurred at a Rand Paul rally the other night, the stomping of the head of a woman from MoveOut.org after she was, excuse me?
Move on, not move out.
Well, I said move on. Did I say move out? move on, whatever. Move on, move out. You know how Move On came together, right? Yeah, it was get over the Clinton stuff. Go ahead and censure him. This is before the Republicans saw a golden once-in-a-lifetime opportunity. Let's impeach him! You know, Move On was put together by people that said, all right, censure him for lying about his relationship to Monica Lewinsky. Censure him and move on. Yes?
Okay, now, I'm confused. I thought Move On started as a result of all the backlash against 9/11, all the people
no,
that
no, no,
saying
no, no.
Move On.
No, no, no,
just
no, no.
Get over it.
Clinton.
Forget about it.
No, no,
it.
No.
Really?
No, no.
What?
It goes, you were in school then. You weren't paying any attention. I was in that studio at WLS every night.
Ninth grade.
I was in that studio at WLS every night. Move On was, they advocated a congressional censure of Clinton and Move On. Go on back to the business of the country. And the Republicans, under the astute leadership of Newt Gingrich and Henry Hyde and some of these other hypocritical sons of bitches who had been cheating on their various wives their entire married lives, they decided to pursue the impeachment. Anyway, the head stomping that occurred against the woman who was with Move On. Couple of things here. Hayward, is it Hayward? Oh, no, that's where he lives. It's Rick. Mike, it seems there might be a tactical benefit of this stomping on the head and having it telecast and YouTubed. There might be a tactical benefit exposing the American public to right-wing violence, but not too much violence to create a large backlash. Just a little head stomping, a little little handcuffing reporters, a little threatening to take a take somebody out, you know. Just enough to shock, Rick writes. Just little enough to bring on right-wing defense to muddy the waters, as in, well, you know, she was trying to get next to Rand Paul. And as Rick writes, that's in line with our 1940s Hitler, 1930s Hitler, make the claims that Jews attack Nazi meetings, etc., and thus require vigorous defensive violence. Oh, yeah. I remember that. Historically, I don't remember it, but I remember reading about the tricks that were used by the brown shirts. Hey, Rick writes, anyway, well, what are your thoughts? Well, that's pretty much, yeah, that's an interesting point of view. I hadn't thought about that. Just enough violence getting out there, not to shock anybody, just to, you know, make most people who are of the right wing, Republicans, who aren't quite ready for fascism but need to be prepared for it because it's coming, just enough to make them say, well, I'll tell you what, Maud, I don't believe in hitting women, you know, but I think she had it coming. They didn't hurt her anyway. Just a little, you know, just a, they keep saying stomped her head. They didn't stomp her head. The guy just had his boot on her head. And further evidence also shows that she was kicked between the legs when she was down. You couldn't see that, I don't think, on that on the one videotape, but it's now become evident according to eyewitnesses. Anyway, Sue wrote to me, said, I don't mean to be incessantly on your back about this story, the Eric Cantor story, where people showed up at a restaurant to hear Eric Cantor give his jive turkey nonsense, and somebody who was there, who was a supporter of Cantor's opponent, wound up being arrested because he was told to leave the restaurant. He had RSVP'd, as the invitation required, and he refused to go. They dragged him out in the street. If you watch that video runs a minute 17. Jesus God, these three fat, obese, ugly, putrid cops in Virginia just dragging this man. They had his arms all twisted around, and they're putting pressure on his neck, on his carotid artery, and these filthy cops are saying, put your arms down! And he can't. They've got him, you know, and so they're putting pressure around his neck. They're actually in the process of killing him. If they don't stop, he is going to die. Well, there's a little bit more about that. I'll share it with you when we come back. Stick around.
Afraid? Be very afraid. It's Mike Malloy.
It's about 10 before the hour. I'll tell you what, I'm gonna hold off on the Eric Cantor violence story here until after the we have our guest at the top of the hour coming up here, because before she's available to us, I just want to go over with you who she is, a little bit about her. Her name is Charlotte Dennett. I don't know if you remember her. She is a member of the Vermont Progressive Party, and she's not a Democrat, not a Republican, Vermont Progressive Party. She's running again this year for that state's attorney general position. She has been practicing law since 1997. She represents injured Vermonters in negligence, medical malpractice, wrongful death cases, as well as civil rights litigation, family law, freedom of information litigation. And she's been an investigative journalist for over 35 years. This is also the woman who responded to Bob Alexander's mailing of hundreds of copies of Vince Bugliosi's book, The Trial of George W. Bush for Murder. And she was the only prosecuting attorney who said, yeah, or the only attorney who said, yeah, if I'm elected, I'll prosecute him. You're damn right I will. That's who this person is. Now, during her professional career, she has successfully used Vermont's public records law to discover collusion between Entergy, that's the company that owns and manages the Vermont Yankee nuclear power plant, a collusion between them and the Department of Health in concealing illegal radiation levels at Vermont Yankee, Department of Health in the state of Vermont. Her latest article in the Huffington Post analyzes the similarities in deceptive advertising by two Louisiana-based giant energy corporations, and they would be Entergy and BP. She successfully used the Federal Freedom of Information Act to obtain evidence of professional misconduct among Bush-appointed torture lawyers in the U.S. Department of Justice. And on behalf of the Justice Robert Jackson Committee, she is currently challenging the CIA's redactions of an internal ethics probe, which shows a conspiracy to commit war crimes involving CIA personnel, top leaders in the Bush administration, and the top lawyers in the Office of Legal Counsel under Bush. You like her already, don't you? She has pursued for over a decade an investigation documenting the role of big oil in misleading Americans while destroying the environments and communities of indigenous peoples in Latin America and the Middle East. And her her results have been published in several books. One, put out by HarperCollins in 1995, Thy Will Be Done, The Conquest of the Amazon. Two, Prometheus Books in 2004, Into the Buzzsaw, Leading Journalists Expose the Myth of a Free Press. And that won the National Press Club Award. And in 2010, this year, the new book, The People Versus Bush, which a Chelsea Green publisher, it carries an endorsement from the now late dead Howard Zinn. She has helped sue one of the worst polluters of the country, DuPont Company, DuPont Chemical, for suppressing her husband's 800-page, widely held, unauthorized biography of the company and the family, titled DuPont Dynasty Behind the Nylon Curtain. She has sued the CIA and successfully recovered documents about her late father, Daniel C. Dennett, who was a diplomat and head of counterintelligence in the Middle East during and immediately after World War II, before dying under mysterious circumstances with five other Americans following a top-secret mission to Saudi Arabia. Wow. She's a strong supporter of women's and children's rights. She's chaired the ERA Task Force for the Vermont chapter of the National Organization for Women in 1986. She served as president of the Franklin County Family Center in St. Albans, a St. Albans-based nonprofit organization which specializes in helping families with parenting classes, child care, and while she was serving, provided advice and assistance to abuse and rape crisis victims. She continues with all sorts of volunteer work. She currently co-teaches courses in politics and economic development at Johnson State College in Vermont. She holds a master's in art history, which she obtained in Florence, Italy, while studying the Italian Renaissance. And in her spare time, she likes to sketch and paint Vermont's beautiful countryside, go for walks with her lab, and all sorts of sporting things. She's traveled widely throughout the Middle East and Latin America as in her role as a journalist. She likes going to Maine to visit her daughter, Mia, and her two adorable little girls, Mia's two little girls, Danny and Ryan. She's been married to her husband, Jerry, for 31 years. The two came to Vermont in 1984 and considered themselves privileged to live in such a wonderful and community-oriented state. I'll tell you right now, if this woman were running for president, I would do everything I could to work for her election. Now, you can go to her go to her website. It's, what is it? It's Char, I think it's Char Dennett. Char Dennett is, let me find it here. I've got it here someplace. I think I do. Charlotte Dennett, D-E-N-N-E-T-T. And I think it's chardennett.org. Anyway, during this break, why don't you check it out? Let me see here, chardennett.org. Yeah, that's it. Char, C-H-A-R, Dennett, D-E-N-N-E-T-T, chardennett.org. And on the left side of her homepage, there's all sorts of things you can find out about her. And take a look. We're going to talk to her when we come back after the break. And you tell me if you wouldn't vote for this woman for president in a heartbeat. Dear God. All right, stick around. I'm Mike Malloy. We'll be talking to Charlotte Dennett as soon as we come back. Campaigning in Vermont, I'm sure that that's probably what she's doing. We will wait. We'll give her the rest of the evening if necessary until she calls in. It either just slipped her mind or she went to our website and said, "Well, I know I've been on with Malloy before, but Jesus God, he's gone insane." No, she'll be here eventually. All right, let me get back to this thing. Sue sent this in. She writes, Mike, I don't mean to be incessantly up your blank about this story, but the story had some interesting coverage on Daily Kos, and she sends me that link. A long post written by John, he's the guy that was arrested, is linked at the end of the article. You can see by reading his post that he's a very thoughtful and articulate individual, hardly an imported thug, as the Cantor crew tried to indicate that he was. Sue writes, he was able finally to find an attorney to represent him, so no need to appeal to your listeners for referrals, as I requested last night. None of the local attorneys in East B.F. Ooh, Sue! In East B.F. Redneckville, Virginia, would take the case. It appears that the owner of the coffee shop is well-connected. John doesn't have access to your show. Internet service down in the boonies isn't conducive to streaming, but he is familiar with it, and I'm sure he would be willing to talk to you if you're interested. And she sent me his number here. But here's the article from Daily Kos. It's not an article. It's an eyewitness account of what happened at the Solid Grounds coffee shop in Louisa, Virginia, Monday. where a Democratic grassroots supporter, the supporter's name is John Taylor, the guy we're talking about, of the Democratic nominee, Rick Wall, was told he had to leave a highly publicized, apparently open to the public rally on Eric Cantor's victory tour. John Taylor was then manhandled by police and arrested. This account is by Luwalda Haney, who was sitting at the table with Taylor when the police came up. She starts out by saying the way Solid Ground said it happened, that's the coffee shop, the way the owner of the coffee shop said it happened was not true. And Luwalda writes, I had just gotten back from getting a cup of coffee and to get Kayla some chocolate milk, and proceeded to sit down at the table near the door. Kayla's one of the kids. Amy then went to get her coffee in return. We were just sitting at the table drinking our coffee, waiting the arrival of Eric Cantor, when the town police came in and started questioning John about parking his car in front. John showed him the receipt showing that he had paid for multiple hours on the parking meter. It burned them up to see John's car parked right in front of the event with all the posters. The town police left. Then, a few minutes later, town and county police approached the table and told John he had to leave. They accused him of being a ringleader trying to cause trouble. Now, there are four other people at the table, two of whom are kids, right? A ringleader trying to cause trouble. At this point, they said the owner of the shop wanted him to leave, the town police and the county police now. And Mr. Minter, I guess that's the owner, came up and did ask John to leave. John was questioning why he had to go and that he had an invitation. Meanwhile, the police roughly helped him from his chair and attempted to put handcuffs on him. I asked what was going on, and nobody objected loudly objected to the action. I said, next you'll say I have to leave. And then the town police acknowledged that that was true. After the incident on the sidewalk, and you can see that video where, like I say, they damn near killed him. Had they continued the hold on the pressure points on his neck, he would have died. After the incident on the sidewalk, the police returned inside and told me he was writing me a summons for trespassing. And then he told Amy she would have to leave also. Amy did not say anything at any point. We were just drinking our coffee, and it would not have happened if the police had not barged and bullied their way to our table. I was under the impression that this was a town hall type of event that was open to the public. not in brown shirt America. No. It could have been handled in a completely civilized manner. We are people who have lived in Louisa for many years and who are known to our friends and neighbors. We're not thugs imported in to cause a disturbance. Interesting to see all of our local officials present and that they didn't protest as to how the citizens of their town, us, were being manhandled. It made me sick. What the hell did Minter mean by saying we were indicating that we were not going to sit quietly during the event? Does sitting at the table with our coffee and grandchild and daughter pose any indication of what our behavior would be later in the event? Does freedom of speech mean anything? And Lokel, who wrote this for Daily Coast, said, I just add that the corporate media's reporting on this incident has been sketchy, lazy, far too willing to take the Cantor campaign spin. And generally, the reporting has been both misleading and unhelpful. Typical, unfortunately, of the lamestream media in its presentation of events. And then there's an update. Cantor's people are trying to blame the victim. Cantor's spokesman Ray Allen Jr. said, quote, this is a pattern with Rick Wall of disruptive and frankly thuggish behavior, and frankly he needs to get control of his campaign, end quote. The Wall campaign, of course, had nothing to do with this. As to the utterly absurd claim that the Wall campaign has been in any way, shape, or form disruptive or thuggish in this campaign, I refer you to an interview that the blogger here did late yesterday with the campaign manager for Cantor's conservative Tea Party opponent, Floyd Bain. According to Bain's campaign manager, Rick Watt's campaign has done absolutely nothing wrong in this campaign, that they are simply exercising their right to free speech and trying to get Eric Cantor to engage in discussion, and that Cantor has been smearing him. And it goes on. Oh, by the way, a little postscript. It's not a surprise when it comes to Eric Cantor or Republicans in general. Also note that Eric Cantor's wife sits on the board of Media General, which owns the Richmond Times-Dispatch. Well, Cantor himself is known to have tremendous influence on the local media. You think the Wall campaign is going to get a fair shake in that environment? LOL. So the violence continues. And you'll notice none of this violence, even back during the so-called town hall meetings, none of this violence is coming from people who are identified as Democrats. Not Democratic candidates, not Democratic supporters of those Democratic candidates. It is all coming from the neo-fascist right. Oh, Charlotte's on the line? Oh, good. Let me just jump in. Hi, Charlotte. We have to take a break here very quickly, but I'm glad
I'm here.
You are indeed. I'm glad you called in.
Thank you.
I was just telling the audience during the last segment before the top of the hour break a few minutes ago, just quoting from your bio page on your website. And I said that if you were running for president right now, I would do everything in my power to work to get you elected.
Wow.
And it's very difficult for me right now to think of politicians, Democrats or Republicans, in anything other than a jaded light, if you know what I mean. But the fact that you are with the Vermont Progressive Party is pretty important. All right, let me put you on hold, Charlotte, and okay. I'll come back in a second and we'll chat, okay?
Very good. Thanks so much.
Okay, stay right there if you would. We'll be right back. What did I say? Stay right there. You don't have to stay right there, Charlotte. Charlotte, you can get up, move around. Oh, God. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Truth seekers, it's time for your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
I would not run from the Holocaust. I would not run from the bomb.
21 past the hour. We are talking for a few minutes here with Charlotte Dennett, who is running for Attorney General in the state of Vermont. She is running on the Vermont Progressive ticket. Last time we talked, Charlotte, you had a campaign going then, too, right?
Yeah, that's right.
What happened?
2 years ago.
Yeah, what happened the last election?
Well, I ran on a promise, among other things, to prosecute George W. Bush for murder.
Right.
And Vince, your friend Vincent Bugliosi, you had Vince on, didn't you?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I'll try to make this as short as possible. Vincent Bugliosi wrote this book, and I read it, and a friend gave it to me.
Oh, yeah, we're real familiar, and with Bob Alexander's efforts and the fact that, I had Bugliosi. I've had Bugliosi on this program. I've had him on as a guest several times over the past 15 years. So, yeah, we know your connection to Vince.
Right.
And indirectly to Bob Alexander in Seattle.
He's a good friend.
He is.
Wonderful work, and he's been very helpful to me.
He is definitely that. But I was curious about. I thought you would win.
Well, look. Here's the thing. I mean, first of all, I was running for the first time, and I really didn't get out there and start campaigning until about a month before the election.
Mm-hmm.
It all happened very fast, and the beauty of it was, what I pledged to prosecute Bush, even though I wasn't a sitting attorney general, which is what Vince Bugliosi wanted,
right,
or a sitting DA, but I figured, hey, I'm running for it, and I'm going to raise the issue, and I totally believe in Bugliosi's case, in both the evidence he assembled and the legal strategy he laid out.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, you know, if there's any state that might enthusiastically embrace this notion, it would be Vermont, for a number of reasons, among them there was this huge animus against Bush. 50% of the people were against the war in Iraq.
Mm-hmm.
We had the town meeting where some 33 towns voted to impeach Bush. And then there was a sad reason, which was that Vermont had the highest per capita loss of soldiers.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, you know, if anyone could make some headway on this issue, then perhaps it could be me in the state of Vermont. Plus, I was running as a progressive. We do have a third party. We are a major party in Vermont. And it means that, you know, I get to be in all the debates. And it's respected as a really viable party. We're probably the most viable third party movement today in the country. So for all those reasons, I knew a Democrat was not going to take this issue up because, you know, they caved on impeachment.
Right.
And that happened in Vermont, too. And I found out a lot about that after I lost the election. I was in a four-way race. I was unknown.
Mm-hmm.
But there was a great deal of enthusiasm at that time. Even when Obama got elected, the number one issue on his website was to criminally investigate Bush and Cheney. And then, unfortunately, well, we all know what Obama did. He said, let's move forward and not move backwards.
Right.
Which I've since taken to be a cue to all the guilty parties in the Bush administration that he wasn't going to pursue prosecution. Because how can you prosecute anyone unless they've done something in the past?
Really?
<You know>? So, but I ended up writing a book about my race because even in that short time period, I got fantastic support from all over the country.
Mm-hmm.
And I got very hooked on this notion of accountability, that our elected leaders have really acted in with impunity. I don't know if it goes with the territory of being wealthy. You know, the wealthier they are, the more removed they are from the rest of us.
Mm-hmm.
But that is a real problem in D.C., and I was finding it to be a real problem in Vermont, perhaps more so than it's ever been. And that's why I decided ultimately to run again. So I did. I'm in the same race. I still hold true to my pledge. At the same time, of course, you know, I have to get out there. I have to campaign. I have to deal with other issues, and which I've done in this race. And yet it's interesting because one of the issues that I ran on 2 years ago has become even bigger this year, and that is retiring our nuclear power plant,
mm-hmm,
called Vermont Yankee.
Right.
We're the only state in the country in which the state legislature can vote to shut it down. And, in fact, this happened in February. Our Senate, we only need one house to say, no, we don't want it to be relicensed. And that happened in February, and there was a good reason it happened in February, where they voted not to renew the license. There were reports of tritium, radioactive,
mm-hmm,
tritium, strontium, and cesium being spilled into our soil and our groundwater by Vermont Yankee. And then we found out.
Hey, listen, Charlotte. Yeah, let me put you on hold for just a second. We'll come back. We got to do some commercials here. We're talking with Charlotte Dennett, who is a progressive candidate for Attorney General in Vermont. Stay with us.
I've been out in front of a dozen dead oceans. I've been 10,000 miles in the mouth of a graveyard. And it's a hard. It's a hard rain that's gonna fall.
more Mr. Nice Guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. We're talking to Charlotte Dennett, who is running for the Office of Attorney General as a Vermont Progressive, on the Vermont Progressive Party ticket. Where were we, Charlotte? Do you remember? If not...
I was sort of getting caught up on email during the break, so of course now I can't even remember where...
I hear you. Well, let me ask you this. Attorney General in the state...
Oh, I know where we were.
Okay, go ahead.
Yeah, I was talking about our nuclear power plant.
Right, right.
But very, very serious issue that really goes to show you what can go wrong when an attorney general does not enforce the law, and when and laws that protect the people from environmental pollution, and what happens when he doesn't carefully monitor what state agencies are doing.
And this is the guy that's in there now.
That's correct, yeah.
Why did the citizens of Vermont allow someone like that? You know, you Vermonters, I spent time in your state. You're a pretty independent group. You know, I can drive around where Massachusetts, Vermont, the Green Mountains, and go right into Vermont, and 100 yards from each other, you can see a Confederate battle flag on the one side of the road. A little bit further down the road, you see a great big peace sign, and you know that these two families or whatever would be politically diametrically opposed, but they live peacefully on the same damn road. And so it's a very diverse group. How do you, in Vermont, how do you folks tolerate an attorney general who, through his inaction, is putting everybody at risk?
Wow, that's so well put, Mike. First of all, a lot of people don't know. They don't know that the Attorney General is involved in this, and that's what my campaign has been about. I've been forced to educate as best I can the people that state government is not looking out for their interests, and it's a difficult task. I'll tell you why it's difficult. For one thing, when you're talking about a nuclear power plant and you're talking about cancer rates, you know that you're going to get attacked or you're not going to be believed.
Mm.
And this is the thing that's really shocking to me, because the cancer rates in Vermont are very high. This little rural state where everything is rolling green and beautiful, and you think at first glance that it's a happy place, it's a progressive place, people have their different viewpoints, but we all get along. And it is a wonderful place to live.
Mm-hmm.
But there is this huge public health risk, in my opinion. And I've just decided I'm going out there, no holds barred, and I'm gonna talk about the C word, which is cancer.
Mm-hmm.
The Nuclear Regulatory Commission had all of the legislators basically silenced on the question of health and safety, because the Nuclear Regulatory Commission took over jurisdiction of health and safety in the middle 90s for all nuclear power plants across the country. And they did so because they knew some of the aging plants were going to be up for relicensing, and people were going to start looking at, what they're not healthy.
And this is such
what about low-level radiation causing cancer?
And it's such a national issue. There are how many scores of nuclear power plants?
Scores that are up for relicensing.
Right.
And trust me on this, the whole nuclear power industry is watching Vermont right now.
Mm-hmm.
One of the reasons is that we're the only state where we can decide the future of this plant. We actually got it written into law. That's another little beautiful thing about Vermont. We love to be first in things.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it's unusual. And our Senate did vote to close this plant. In February, after we had found out two alarming things. Number one, that high levels of radioactive strontium, what was leaking
mm-hmm.
into the soil and the groundwater around the plant. And then the other thing we found out is that Entergy officials, they own the plant, Vermont Yankee,
right.
Louisiana-based, by the way. Entergy officials were misleading state officials about the existence of underground pipes which were leaking the radiation.
Gee, there's a surprise. There's a surprise. Misleading the regulators. Oh, gosh. That doesn't happen anywhere.
That was the thing that really tipped the balance.
Right.
When we found out that they were lying to us Oh, my goodness. But then the story gets bigger. I mean, just I cannot begin to tell you how big the story is, Mike. And I've got an investigative journalist up here with me, Christina Borgeson, helping me on this. She helped me 2 years ago. And so what we've been doing is putting out press releases as often as we can. Here's just some of the highlights of what we've discovered. First of all, we found out that the Attorney General was actually advising the Health Department to avoid telling the legislature about increased radiation.
Good God.
This was 2 years ago. They kept it quiet. What happened is the Health Department, when they found out the plant was operating at 20% more power than it used to, everyone knew that meant 20% more low-level radiation. Mm-hmm. But instead of reporting this, of course, which would have caused the plant to close down because it was exceeding acceptable levels, they concocted a new formula for measuring radiation. They did it in secret. This sounds like Bush, right?
It does.
They did it in secret and at the advice of the Attorney General. And they didn't tell the legislature. If they had told the legislature about this new formula, which was tantamount to a rule change, then there would have been public hearings, and instead there weren't any.
You know,
anyway,
what comes
around goes around or whatever, and they found out about it, and the Health Department was grilled, and that's when I found out that the Attorney General had given this advice how to avoid the legislature. So that's just the beginning.
We know, Charlotte, in a sane world, Sorrell,
yeah,
your current Attorney General, in a sane world, wouldn't he be subject to a criminal action? His job, unless I misunderstand, Attorney General, he's the chief law enforcement officer of the state of Vermont, any state, the Attorney General.
Well,
that's
well, it's rather interesting because he's denying it quite vociferously, but I've got evidence, including I've got testimony from other legislators. They've known for some time that the Attorney General was playing this role.
Are you putting this out so people know about it?
Oh, yeah. It's on my website. We're putting out, progressiveparty.org,
mm-hmm,
you will see our press releases on the website. Here's another example, which is, to me, is totally shocking. Is that the same health department has been putting out one set of documents to the public, which basically poo-poos the cancer rate. You know, nothing to be concerned about. And they withheld from the public, which means they suppressed a document showing that there's been a 400% increase in thyroid cancer among women in the past decade. And the only reason we know about this document is because a nurse who knows about thyroid cancer kept pressing the health department for more specific documentation, and the health department finally gave it to her, said, don't release this without our permission. And when she saw what the document showed, she was so angry, she made it public. And so I have to, you know, what we're doing is I've asked the Attorney General, I said, you need to get on top of your health department and make sure that they are giving Vermonters accurate information. I mean, can you imagine what it's like living around a nuclear power plant?
Well, I don't live too far. There's several that the Southern Company owns here in Georgia, a couple of which are also, at least one I know of, is up for renewal. I can remember back in 78. How many years ago was that? 32 years ago when I was active in the anti-nuke movement here in the Southeast, and it was right around that time that Plant Vogtle, Plant Hatch, a couple of these nuclear reactor were built here, and now they're up for renewal. And one of the grievous things about Obama is his willingness to go right along with the nuclear power industry, and they have opened up now the licensing process. There's not an insurance company on earth that will insure these companies. So who's going to insure them? Ding, ding, the federal government, which means
means us. So, I am just so thoroughly pissed at certainly Republicans. To me, they're almost subhuman. But Democrats, I've just had enough. I've had my belly full, as my mother used to say. The fact that you're running as a member of the Progressive Party or a candidate on the Progressive Party ticket, I think is very, very, very important to people around the country.
I want to thank you for that. I appreciate it.
Yeah, and I wish you had more time to talk here, Charlotte. We're coming up on another break. I'm just going to ask for people to go to your website, Char, Dennett, Dennett.org, Chardennett.org, and to check out what you have there. And like I said, if you were running for national office, I would do everything I could to try to help get you elected.
I really need people's support right now. It's a crucial battle. And don't kid yourself, the nuclear industry is watching this very carefully.
Sure, sure.
Because what's happened is, even though we voted to close the thing, mm-hmm. our Senate, Entergy is right in there. They're putting out their ridiculous ads, which I've written about on Huffington Post.
And Tuesday's the day.
What?
Tuesday's the day. You got three, four days left. All right, Charlotte, thanks. I hope the next time we talk, I'll be addressed.
We can talk about Bush's book.
And I'll address you as Miss Attorney General. Thanks a lot for being on the program.
Thanks so much, Mike.
All right, take care.
Bye.
Charlotte Dennett, please go to her website. Please take a look at what's there. Please, I don't give a damn where you live. Please support this candidate. Will you do that? Thank you. We'll be right back.
Some writers and critics who prophesize with your pen and keep your eyes wide, the chance won't.
Monkey-free fun and frivolity with Mike Malloy.
The neo-fascists are at hand, and come Tuesday, if you believe the pundits and the people who really know, these brain-dead teabag freaks are going to be in control of the country, at least from a political point of view. They in turn will be controlled by the corporatists, who relish the idea that people this stupid are going to take over the Congress, if you believe the pundits. I had something here. Oh, yeah. We're talking about this insane belief. Well, by the way, before I forget, if you go to Gawker.com, Gawker, G-A-W-K-E-R, there's a guy there, and there's a bunch of photos, a guy there who's written a piece about his one-night stand with Christine O'Donnell. Now, I don't know if it's for real. Gawker is a pretty reliable site, and there are about 10 or 12 photos there that they're not Photoshopped. It looks like they were taken with a digital camera. Nothing naked, nothing, just, you know, you should go there. Anyway, we're talking the other night, we've been talking about the willingness, the willing suspension of disbelief that these poor, miserable Republicans and conservatives and right-wingers and teabaggers involve themselves in order to believe people like Glenn Beck or Sarah Palin. And Michael in Roswell sent me a quick paragraph here from Eric Hoffer's The True Believer. I've mentioned The True Believer many times. It's written in the 50s. Eric Hoffer was a longshoreman philosopher. He worked with his hands, but he was also a philosopher. And I don't know what else he wrote, but The True Believer I read when I was about 17, 18 years old, and it profoundly affected me in that it gave me an encyclopedia of inside information about the workings of the mind of the true believer. And it's helped me all my life. If you haven't read The True Believer, you ought to read it. This is taken from that book. All active mass movements strive, therefore, to interpose a fact-proof screen between the faithful and the realities of the world. They do this by claiming that the ultimate and absolute truth is already embodied in their doctrine, and that there is no truth nor certitude outside it. The facts on which the true believer bases his conclusions must not be derived from his experience or observation, but from Holy Writ. Quote, so tenaciously should we cling to the world revealed by the gospel, that were I to see all the angels of heaven coming down to tell me something different, not only would I not be tempted to doubt a single syllable, but I would shut my eyes and stop up my ears, for they would not deserve to be either seen or heard. End quote. To rely on the evidence of the senses and of reason is heresy and treason. It is startling to realize how much unbelief is necessary to make belief possible. Eric Hoffer, true believer. And that is so essentially true. Now, he uses there the example of an evangelical Christian, but it applies to anybody. You can be a totalitarian of any stripe, right wing, left wing, follower, and you will believe what is put into your head by your organization, by your leader. This is the problem, or the reality, I should say, with people who listen to Limbaugh and Beck. It doesn't make any difference what facts are presented, what objective reality, if such a thing exists, is presented to them. It doesn't make any difference. It doesn't make any difference. The facts on which the true believer bases his conclusions must not be derived from his own experience or observation, but from Holy Writ. And Holy Writ, to people who listen to Beck or Limbaugh, are what Beck and Limbaugh say. And their ilk. These right-wingers, the teabaggers, these crazy sons of bitches. And it's a shame. You almost... Wrong pronoun. I almost want to feel some kind of pity for these freaks, but I can't. All I feel for followers of this neo-fascist dogma, ideology, Holy Writ, is utter, profound contempt. And the reason it's contempt is because they are presented daily with the same sets of reality-based facts as I am or you are. And yet they choose, as Hoffer says here, they choose to deny, you know, who said it? What are you going to believe? Your lying eyes or what I tell you? And that's why they make me furious. I hate willful ignorance. You know, we all have to deal with ignorance. We all start out ignorant, totally ignorant. But the hope is that over the course of one's lifetime, starting very early, you begin to lose the ignorance and replace it with understanding and knowledge and awareness and comprehension and desire for more of that. But that's not what happens to the true believer. Who was it said, give me a child till he's six and I'll give you a Catholic for life? You can, and you can fill, you can take out the word Catholic and put any dogmatic word in there you want to put in. You know, I've said it before, if you have not read The True Believer, it's just a series of essays. Some of them are only two sentences long. Some of them are four or five pages. But if you haven't read The True Believer, Eric Hoffer, H-O-F-F-E-R, I have one question for you. Why not? I mean, and this is written over half a century ago, but if you read The True Believer, all of a sudden, everything will come clear about this neo-fascism and why people actually listen and do as instructed by the teabaggers, the teabagger leadership. All right, when we come back, this article about Paul Wolfowitz, this investigative piece, that you may have a hard time believing, but I trust these writers, Jeffrey Kay and Jason Leopold. Stick around. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy.
7 past the hour. I want to move on now to one of those long form pieces that we occasionally do in this program that I think are necessary to get out, where there might be some public attention paid to it. Mainstream media, and that phrase is starting to stick in my throat every time I use it. I doubt if they're going to touch this. Jeffrey Kay and Jason Leopold, two investigative journalists writing for Truthout, have researched and put together a report regarding Paul Wolfowitz, who at the time was Deputy Defense Secretary. Wolfowitz is a very strange character. After he left the Bush administration, he took a job at the World Bank, which he then left because of charges of, if not sexual harassment, trying to get his girlfriend a job. I mean, just strange stuff. Nothing unusual. Nothing unusual there at all. Wolfowitz, of course, is Jewish. His further description regarding the state of Israel would have to be Zionist. And I don't use that as a pejorative. That's just a descriptive term. But I think it's pertinent to what Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay have discovered. Now, Wolfowitz was born in Brooklyn and New York. He's not an immigrant. His family are Polish Jews. They came to this country to escape the pogroms that occurred after World War I. Huh? After World War I. His father escaped Poland after World War I. And the rest of his father's family perished in the Holocaust that developed during World War II. And Wolfowitz claims to be a scholar of both our bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki and what happened to the Jews and other groups in Europe during World War II, the mass killings, the death, the burnings, the gassings. How could you be Jewish and not focus on that aspect of a group's collective history? How could you not? So, putting that aside, but filing it where you can, the reason I bring it up is because, in my opinion, it applies to this story. Wolfowitz ordered a directive written, titled "Protection of Human Subjects and Adherence to Ethical Standards in Department of Defense supported research." Ooh, does that sound like something right out of Mengele's mouth? Protection of human subjects and adherence to ethical standards in Department of Defense supported research. Research, where you have to protect human subjects. Uh-oh. In 2002, Jason and Jeffrey, right, at Truthout, in 2002, as the Bush administration was turning to torture and other brutal techniques for interrogating so-called war on terror detainees, Deputy Defense Secretary Paul Wolfowitz loosened rules against human experimentation. An apparent recognition of legal problems regarding the novel strategies for extracting and evaluating information from people that we scooped up in Afghanistan, Iraq, Pakistan, wherever. Wolfowitz issued a little-known directive on March 25, 2002,
About a month after George W. Bush stripped the detainees of traditional prisoner of war protections under the Geneva Conventions. Remember that? Bush labeled these people unlawful enemy combatants, a term completely made up, Truthseeker. Remember that? Surely, this is only 8 years ago. I know you remember. Unlawful enemy combatants. What the hell is that? Well, it was designed to deny protection to people that the Bush crime family decided they wanted to torture. It's that simple. Anyway, when Bush labeled people unlawful enemy combatants, he also authorized the CIA and the Department of Defense to undertake brutal interrogations. And despite its title, Protection of Human Subjects and Adherence to Ethical Standards of Department of Defense-Supported Research, the Paul Wolfowitz directed weakened protections that had been in place for decades. By limiting the safeguard to so-called prisoners of war. I don't understand. I'm sure psychologists in the audience can explain this. How someone like Wolfowitz, and there were so many Jews in the Bush administration who were involved in dismantling protections and rules put together specifically as a result of the horrors visited upon the Jews during World War II. How members of that faith or that culture can then, 50 years later, take those protections and definitions apart is beyond me, and subject a new group of people to basically the same lack of protections that the Jews had in Germany and most of Europe in the 1920s and 30s. This is astonishing to me. It really is. Wolfowitz said about the war on so-called terror detainees 4 days before signing the new directive, quote, "We're dealing with a special breed of person here," end quote. We're dealing, in reference to the people who were, in some instances, sold to American CIA operatives in Afghanistan, Iraq, and Pakistan. Wolfowitz's words, "We're dealing with a special breed of person here." And consequently, he felt the need to issue this directive that took apart protections put in place because of what happened to his tribe, his people. One former Pentagon official said the Wolfowitz directive provided legal cover for a top secret so-called special access program at the Guantanamo Bay prison, which experimented on ways to glean information from unwilling subjects and to achieve what was referred to as deception detection. Experiments to come up with more effective means of torture and eventually murder. Because as we know, to a very slight degree, people at Guantanamo and Bagram and other darkened torture facilities that were set up by the United States CIA, the Bush crime family, Department of Defense, and Justice Department during this time, people were eventually, after being tortured, murdered. This Pentagon official said, quote, "A dozen high-value detainees were subjected to interrogation methods in order to evaluate their reaction to those methods and the subsequent levels of stress that would result," end quote. In other words, they were not looking for information from the select group. They were looking to see, as Dr. Josef Mengele looked to see, what kind of reaction the human body, physically or psychologically, would develop as a result of torture. We'll be right back.
loud, proud, progressive talk. It's Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Continuing the piece that was at Truth Out a few days ago, written by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, about Paul Wolfowitz ordering the redefinition of torture and ordering experimentation on detainees, if you can believe it. A July 16th, 2004, Army Criminal Investigation Division report obtained by Truth Out shows that between April and July of 2003, a, quote, psychological warfare specialist, end quote, attached to the military Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape Program, that's the SEER program, was present at Guantanamo. The CID report says the instructor was assigned to a top-secret special access program. It has been known since 2009, when President Obama declassified some of the Bush administration legal memoranda regarding the interrogation program, that there were experimental elements to the brutal treatment of detainees, including the sequencing and duration of the torture and other harsh tactics. Experimental elements to torture. Experimental elements. I mean, the word torture is horrifying enough, but when you preface the word torture with the two words experimental elements. Jesus Christ. I mean, the leadership of this country had fallen. I mean, the top level leadership, this kind of stuff, is, I guess, part of the human condition, torturing people. It's part of the reptilian aspect of our, not just our physiological makeup, but our psychological makeup too, right? You know, the experiments that have been done with college students listening to pain in another room and whether or not to adjust the pain levels higher based on what the experimenter tells them. You understand that. But son of a bitch, these are the elected leaders of the United States saying to each other, we have got to issue protections for each other. We have got to come up with programs designed to take these poor, miserable bastards we sweep up around the world and put them under such extreme pressure that they'll admit to anything to justify the fact that we've declared war on the world. Endless war for endless profit. There has to be justification. Okay, let's experiment. My God. The Wolfowitz directive also suggests that the Bush administration was concerned about whether its actions might violate Geneva Convention's rules that were put in place after World War II when grisly Nazi human experimentation was discovered. Those legal restrictions put in place were expanded in the 1970s after revelations about the CIA testing drugs on unsuspecting human subjects and conducting other mind control experiments. You know, MKUltra. According to a Department of Defense spokeswoman, Wendy Snyder, quote, the DOD insists that it has never condoned nor authorized the use of human research testing on any detainee in our custody, end quote. However, from the start of the war on terror, so-called, the Bush administration employed non-traditional methods for designing interrogation protocols, including the reverse engineering of training given to American troops trapped behind enemy lines called the SEER techniques. For instance, the controlled drowning techniques of waterboarding. Retired U.S. Air Force Captain Michael Sean Kearns, a former SEER intelligence officer, said the Wolfowitz directive appears to be a clear attempt to shield then-Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld from the legal consequences of any research practices associated with the interrogation program. There's Mengele again. There he is. Jesus God. an attempt to shield Donald Rumsfeld from experimental programs or techniques or practices associated with the interrogation program. Do you understand what that means? I hope you do. Scott Horton, a human rights attorney and constitutional expert, noted Wolfowitz's specific reference to, quote, prisoners of war, end quote, as protected under the directive, as opposed to referring more generally to detainees or people under the government's control. This is why it was necessary, you see, truth seeker, to come up with a different term. Well, prisoners of war, Jesus God, those damn Geneva Conventions and all sorts of international agreements. So let's come up with a different term. Now do you understand why the term illegal enemy combatants was coined? Enemy combatants, illegal enemy combatants. Unlawful enemy combatants, illegal, unlawful, same thing. Because all of a sudden, we had a new class of detainee on which these experiments could be performed, giving full legal cover to Wolfowitz, Cheney, Bush, and the rest of these monsters.
How it speaks.
Arm yourself with the truth. It's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour, the investigative piece at Truth Out by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, in my opinion, probably warrants at least an equal amount of attention as to the WikiLeaks just dumped with 400,000 documents about Iraq. And the reason is because in the Jason Leopold, Jeffrey Kay investigative piece, you find that the highest officers, civilian officers, in the United States government, devised ways to reauthorize torture experiments. Not necessarily all that unlike, unless it's a matter of degree, what was perpetrated against the Jews, the homosexuals, the socialists, the Russians, anyone swept up in the Nazi death camps. And again, the name Joseph Mengele comes to mind for me. Now, again, going back to Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay's piece, at the time that Wolfowitz was issuing this directive, and it was entitled Protection of Human Subjects and Adherence to Ethical Standards in Department of Defense-Supported Research. I mean, it's a chilling title to begin with. Anyway, at the time that Wolfowitz was issuing this directive, the Bush administration was taking the position that prisoners taken in this endless war on terror were not prisoners of war under the Geneva Conventions, were not entitled to any of the protections of the Geneva Conventions. And that's the reason they came up with the unlawful enemy combatant title. Indeed, according to Scott Horton, a human rights attorney, it called those protections privileges that were available only to, quote, lawful combatants, end quote. Privileges. The Geneva Conventions were re-identified as privileges. So the statement in the directive that prisoners of war cannot be subjects of human experimentation raises some concerns. Why was the more restrictive term prisoners of war used instead of prisoners, for instance? Well, it's very obvious. Because if all of the detainees that we snatched were referred to as prisoners of war, then it would be very difficult for Wolfowitz and Cheney and you and the rest of these monsters to sidestep or bypass the Geneva Conventions. So, very simply, you corrupt language. You change language. Ministry of Peace. Ministry of Truth. Unlawful enemy combatants. It's very simple. The Wolfowitz directive also changed other rules regarding waivers of informed consent. Informed consent. Yes, you may torture me, Proceed. After the scandals over the CIA's MKUltra program and the Tuskegee experiments on African Americans suffering from syphilis, Congress passed legislation known as the Common Rule to provide protections to human research subjects. The Common Rule, quote, requires a review of proposed research by an institutional review board. It also requires the informed consent of research subjects and institutional assurances of compliance with the regulations. So, if you are going to experiment on human beings, say you have a new anti-pancreatic cancer drug, then you go to people dealing with pancreatic cancer and you say, this new drug is A, B, C, and D. It may produce these results, A, B, C, or D. There's also the possibility of death. There's the possibility of cure. We don't know. Do you want to be part of the research protocol? And then it's up to the person to say no or yes. Informed consent. The Wolfowitz Directive also changes language. Oh, excuse me, I've skipped a line. However, according to the Wolfowitz Directive, waivers of informed consent could be granted by the heads of Department of Defense divisions. In other words, you didn't have to ask the person any longer. Well, obviously. And the whole thing is a farcical example of how Dr. Mengele thought. If you ask people, may we torture you, what is the answer going to be? Well, I don't think so. But if you change the definitions, or if you remove from the torturee the right of informed consent and assign it to the heads of the Department of Defense experimental squads, why, you've solved the problem. You don't ask the torturee anymore, you ask the torturer. Waivers of informed consent could be granted by the heads of Department of Defense divisions. Mengele is envious, Mr. Wolfowitz. The Wolfowitz Directive also changes language that had required Department of Defense researchers to strictly adhere to the Nuremberg Directives for Human Experimentation and other precedents when conducting human subject research. Let me pause for a second. You realize what we're talking about here? Do you understand what we're talking? Okay, good. The Nuremberg Code, which was a response, direct response to the Nazi atrocities, made, quote, the voluntary consent of the human subject absolutely essential, end quote. Voluntary consent. If you're going to do experiments, medical, psychological, physiological, anatomical, whatever, the voluntary consent of the human subject absolutely essential. This is in direct response to Dr. Joseph Mengele and what he did to people, to Jews, to a handful of Catholics, more than a handful, to Democrats, to socialists, to Russians, to whomever. However, the Wolfowitz Directive softened a requirement of strict compliance up to this code, instructing researchers simply to be familiar with the Nuremberg Code. They didn't have to apply it, just be familiar with it. Stephen Saltz, director of the Center for Research, Evaluation, and Program Development at Boston Graduate School of Psychoanalysis, says, quote, why are Department of Defense-funded investigators just required to be familiar with the Nuremberg Code rather than required to comply with it? Good question. Saltz also wondered why, quote, enforcement was moved from the Army Surgeon General to someone else in the medical chain of command, or someone else in the medical chain of command, to the Director of Defense Research and Engineering, and why this directive changed at this time as the so-called War on Terror was just getting going. Okay, so the enforcement of non-experimentation on detainees under the control of the Army Surgeon General. Well, that kind of makes sense, doesn't it? Huh? Not to Wolfowitz. You have to move it to somebody else. Ooh, I know. Let's move it to the Director of Defense Research and Engineering. Saltz is the co-author of a report published in June by the International Doctors Organization Physicians for Human Rights, PHR, which found that high-value detainees who were subjected to brutal torture techniques by the CIA were used as, quote, guinea pigs, end quote, to gauge the effectiveness of the various, quote, enhanced interrogation, end quote, methods. An investigation by Physicians for Human Rights found that the people we were picking up, who had never been charged with a crime, they were just being held as unlawful enemy combatants. They were detainees, weren't even prisoners. No rights, nothing. They were being subjected to torture techniques and used as guinea pigs. PHR told Truthout it first examined the Wolfowitz directive and changes Congress made to 10 U.S.C. 980. That's the law that governs how the Defense Department spends federal funds on human experimentation. Jesus, goddamn. I don't know if I can keep talking about this. PHR told Truthout it first examined the Wolfowitz directive and changes Congress made to the law that governs how the Defense Department spends several federal funds on human experimentation in 2008 while preparing its report, but did not cite either because the group could not explain its significance. Physicians for Human Rights saw this and they couldn't explain what it meant. Well, obviously they couldn't. Because nobody on earth, except the inner circle of the Bush crime family, knew what they were doing. Changing language. Nullifying the Geneva Conventions. Nullifying all the results of the Nuremberg war trials. Especially that section on human experimentation. This is what the Bush crime family was doing. And the Physicians for Human Rights looked at this report and said, it couldn't be what we think it is. They didn't know what it was. Back in Congress, the concerns from the Office of Management and Budget, don't ask me why, I have no idea, about loose terminology, about changing language, all that was brushed aside and the law was amended to give the Department of Defense greater leeway regarding experimentation on human subjects. The Republicans, and not a few Democrats, decided, well, Bush and Cheney and Wolfowitz, they know better than we do. Here, let us loosen the language of the law. Now go ahead, boys. Do what you will.
We are fighting, oh, why do we keep on lighting these fires, these bombs? We don't know what's gone wrong. We're getting where we've come from, and all of it.
Before the hour. Now, while all this was going on, while Wolfowitz and Rumsfeld and Bush and Cheney and the rest of these Nazis were taking the United States around the Geneva Conventions, taking the United States around prohibitions on torture and human experimentation, taking the United States around the decisions made by the Nuremberg courts in Germany subsequent to World War II. While these people, these American people, were doing this, Congress, what was Congress doing? Well, according to Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay, as planning for the highly classified special access program began to take shape, most officials in Congress appeared to have averted their eyes. We didn't know anything. Well, we didn't know. Now, I'm not going to get through this whole thing because it's rather lengthy, but please, if you don't do anything else, go to truthout.org and read this entire investigative piece by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay. Wolfowitz Directive gave legal cover to detainee experimentation program. Just go to Truthout and type in Jason Leopold in their search engine. You'll find it. About Wolfowitz. Going back to the report, in his directive, Wolfowitz also made subtle but significant word changes. While retaining the blanket prohibition against experimenting on prisoners of war, Wolfowitz softened the language for other types of prisoners, using a version of rules about, quote, vulnerable, end quote, classes of individuals taken from regulations meant for civilian research by the Department of Health and Human Services. Wolfowitz, in other words, found language in a different branch of government that had to do with honest-to-God medical research and adopted it into his directive regarding torture. I mean, if that doesn't stun you, that we have this kind of human waste in the highest levels of government, I don't know what it would take. Joe Miller hiring thugs, Eric Cantor allowing people to be beaten up, arrested. Okay, really, really bad. But this, the research and experimentation examined physiological markers of stress, such as cortisol, and involved psychologists under contract to the CIA and the military who were experts in the field. Now, this is where this was touched on a couple of years ago when the reports first started coming out, that medical doctors and PhDs were participating by evaluating the results of these experiments and making suggestions. Cortisol, what is that, Kathy? A fear, a stress hormone that can give you a heart attack. It can do anything to you. One study called the Warfighter's Stress Response was conducted between 2002 and 2003 and examined physiological measurements of mock torture subjects drawn from the SEER program and other high-stress military personnel such as Special Forces combat divers. Researchers measured cortisol and other hormone levels via salivary swabbing of blood samples, a process that was also reportedly done to detainees. Here, let's torture them. Remember Mengele. All right, give me a naked Jew. Here you are, Herr Mengele. Thank you. Now, let me submerge the naked Jew into a huge vat of ice and water. An experiment to see how much of this kind of environment our glorious soldiers can handle if they have to take to the North Sea. Put the Jew in the tub of ice water. And on and on and on and on. Only this time it wasn't a Jew. It was probably a Muslim. And most assuredly, someone who was swept up by the CIA, the DOD, the DIA, and handed over to these monsters for experimentation. Just when you think it can't get any worse, it gets worse. Please go to truthout.org. The report is by Jason Leopold and Jeffrey Kay. And the title is Wolfowitz Directive Gave Legal Cover to Detainee Experimentation Program. Now, you and I can do what the good Germans and the good Italians and the good Eastern and Western Europeans did, we can avert our eyes and say, well, I didn't know. I didn't know anything about this. I had no idea. I had no idea. And that may be the only thing that will help you deal with what is being done in your name. On the other hand, it might be a good idea to be aware of this stuff so that when future historians write this bloody, filthy chapter on American history, they won't have a line in there that references the American people claiming, I knew nothing. I didn't know. I had no idea. And perhaps reading Leopold and Kay's article might help you understand why this endless war on terror is exactly that, an endless war. And why and how you and yours and me and mine are going to feel the results of that war. I'll see you tomorrow. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.